you can buy existing productions called PDP, so proven developed producing wells with proven reserves that are already in production. You can buy that future cash flow at a really, really good present value, and you're not having to pay for the upside of the potential drilling that can happen in those that acreage that you buy, rights to.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to the Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea, and it's just me today as we interview Ben Frazier from Aspen Funds. Very excited about this podcast episode. Ryan is away for the day. I'm actually really bummed that he can't join us because this is going to be a really interesting episode that surrounds oil and gas investing as an asset class. Oil and gas investing is something that Turbine Capital has been interested in pursuing for the better part of a year. We've brought on multiple advisors to our team, some of which should be publicly noted soon. And we've been pursuing diligence on some direct-to-sponsorship oil and gas opportunities, but Aspen Funds is about 2 years ahead of us in the space. You may recognize them from the Iron Horse offering and the independent self-storage offering that we did back last year. And very sophisticated shop. Ben Frazier is incredible, knows a lot about the investment space, and very excited to talk to him today about oil and gas investing and as it relates to this moment in history that we have right now that is one of the best times that we've seen, at least in my investing career, to explore the asset class and the tax benefits associated with it. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Ben, thanks so much for coming on the show. We appreciate having you.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. So would you first off just maybe give it a little bit of background on yourself and Aspen Funds before we dive in?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background, I'm a principal at Aspen Funds. I'm the chief investment officer. So I basically help find all the deals that we do and help form the capital for them, and really love that. But prior to joining Aspen about 6 years ago is when I started Aspen. Before that, I was in commercial banking for a good amount of time. I was an underwriter and a lender for many years, basically underwriting and making sure deals would pencil. Did a lot of real estate, did a lot of business loans, and really learned a lot through that time. So really looked under the hood of, what are the wealthiest clients and borrowers of the bank doing, because it got to look at their personal financial statements as one of the kind of key components of underwriting. And so it's kind of a free look as a young, impressionable, someone making not so much money early on, but could see what the very successful people were doing. And it really came down to investing in, alternative assets, investing in businesses, a lot of real estate, and really got me excited about this world of private equity. And so kind of made the leap. Like I said, about 6 years ago, and have been doing that ever since.
That's excellent. Well, as I mentioned in the intro, we've been involved in two very successful projects with you on the real estate side. And I wanted to kind of kick things off on this podcast, just talking about macroeconomics. As you mentioned, you got to see what the wealthy were doing. And obviously, I think that oil and gas is a space that a lot of retail investors aren't really aware of. So before we get into sort of the nuts and bolts of oil and gas investing, you kind of walk us through what's happening in the macroeconomics behind the scenes, globally, that may be driving, a lucrative time to get into this and where we are historically.
Yeah, absolutely. So, first kind of caveat by saying, we started looking at this space a couple of years ago, and we've heard a lot of mixed things about investing in oil and gas. And, I think most people know someone that has had an experience, and it's usually pretty polarizing, right? It's either, oh man, I did really well, made a lot of money, or yeah, I invested in a bad deal and they were crooks. And, it really kind of seemed to be one or the other. And so as we started kind of just doing our macro analysis, which is kind of how we invest, right? We look at a top-down approach first. We want to look at what are the big trends that are going to support the investment themes that we believe in, so that we can make sure we're on the right side of, you know, the economic tides, right? We want the tides, you know, working to our benefit, not against us. And as we started getting really interested in oil and gas investing, you know, we kind of had to learn the ropes a couple of years ago, investing personally into this space. We did our first fund and now onto this fund, and I've learned a lot along the way, but we'll get to talk more into that here in a little bit. But from a macroeconomic standpoint, what really intrigued us, you know, was looking at just at a really high level, take a step back, looking at just the simple supply and demand reality of where we're at now and where we're projected to go over the next really decade, if not several decades. And so if you think about oil and gas, you know, it's really the foundational fuels of our entire, you know, global system, you know, especially gasoline and just oil in general is really the mother of all commodities. It's used in everything, in transportation, in manufacturing, and it's in plastics. I mean, it's in kind of everything that we take for granted as an economy. And one of the interesting things is as we've kind of been making this big push to alternative fuel sources and really have for the past several decades, right, where the all the incentives are for the green energies like solar, wind, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they haven't made a huge dent in the total supply of energy up to this point. And even though kind of the green revolution, so to speak, is probably going to happen at some point, I think most people in the space are overestimating that transition and the how quick it's going to happen, right? If you look at just the fundamental aspects that have to happen for, you know, green energy, alternative energy sources to truly, you know, take root and be able to take the majority of our global energy needs, it's going to take a long time. I can get break down some of those reasons why, but at a really high level, you look at, because of that focus on these alternative fuel sources, it's really kind of pushed a lot of capital allocators out of the market in oil and gas. And so if you look over the past 7 to 8 years, the private equity funding in this space of oil and gas investing has dropped by over half, by 50%, 50%. And if you think about it, that's a really big problem in this type of an asset because oil and gas is a naturally depleting resource, right? It's different than real estate, something that's, you know, appreciates over time. It depletes. You're actually, there's a fixed amount of oil or gas in the ground. As you extract it through production, there's less of it in the ground. And so if you're not constantly drilling new wells, you are basically taking away future supply. And so if you look at kind of this, the production as this being invested in over the past 7 years, it's dropped a massive amount. Meanwhile, demand for fossil fuels is projected by the IEA, which is, you know, one of these big proponents of moving to alternative energy sources. You know, there's just ranges of outcomes for where are we at from a, you know, energy usage standpoint 10 years from now. But it's on the low end, at least the same demand that we have right now. If in the high end, you know, quite a bit more than what we need right now. And so just simple economics with supply and demand, you know, we have a declining supply curve and it's inelastic, right? It's not supply, you just flip a switch and all of a sudden you get more oil all of a sudden. You know, these are, you know, drilling programs that can take several years to develop, to permit, to do the testing and to actually get production out of the ground, can take many years. And so it's not something you can just all of a sudden, if we have, you know, more demand, flip a switch. So we kind of see this, you know, we even go as far to say a brewing energy crisis on the horizon at some point over the next decade, where demand is going to be strong, supply is going to be reduced, and there's going to be this kind of day reckoning of prices. And so we're wanting to get in right now and buy as much as we can, because on the flip side of that, we can actually buy assets at a really good basis, historically speaking, and we can underwrite deals without any price appreciation in them and get pretty incredible return on equity. just because of the lack of private equity funding that has kind of gone into the space. So there's a lot of information there. I'm going to pause there because I know you probably have a lot of follow-up questions here.
Yeah. So super interesting. I mean, most people, I think, consider, oil and gas to be, well, at least oil, natural gas, I think, is a different story. But most people think, okay, we're transitioning to sustainable aviation fuels. We're sort of coming off of our reliance of oil. Can you talk a little bit about what the big oil companies are doing, Exxon, Shell, BP, what's happening with their production and sort of the relationship between the big guys, the middle, and the very small operators?
Yeah, and it's a really interesting space as we've kind of, like I said, been investing for a few years and talking with a lot of people that have been in the space for many, many decades. And what's the experience been right now relative to the past? And what's really interesting is because of a lot of these, ESG initiatives, and ESG is environmental, societal, governance initiatives. And so there's these kind of focuses and incentives that are given towards alternative energies and other things that are going to be environmentally friendly. Fossil fuel is not generally considered environmentally friendly. Regardless, the kind of headlines for this ESG kind of pushes are not only disincentivizing, but actually penalizing these fossil fuel companies from more production and actually the investment into those companies. And so a lot of the big capital allocators, that the big funds that are generally investing in alongside of these companies are not doing so. And so there is actually what's bizarre right now is, a lot of these big companies are seeing this kind of impending future problem that we're creating by not drilling now. But they're okay to do it because what's that likely going to do? It's likely going to increase prices. And who's going to be the beneficiary of that is these kind of big, operators. And a lot of them are sitting on a big cash reserves. They've kind of deleveraged. They've paid down a lot of debt. And what's actually kind of happened in the industry as a whole is, kind of with the commodity price cycle, can create a lot of exuberance, then a lot of like fear as commodity prices can be very volatile. But from the last kind of big commodity price crash, a few years ago, there's actually been a lot more restraint kind of brought into the market from a drilling standpoint. And the idea behind a lot of these bigger companies is we don't want to overproduce, right? We know we need to produce more, but we actually don't want to overproduce because we don't want to tank oil prices. And so we've actually kind of seen, last summer, oil prices spike up pretty big and they've kind of come down a little bit, but they've kind of normalized at this $70, $80 a barrel range, which is a really healthy place from a price standpoint for a lot of these companies. So yeah. I know you probably want to tease out that question a little bit more, but it's an interesting time in the market where there's a lot of need, but there hasn't been a lot of activity. And because of that, I think it's actually a great time to be buying because there isn't this massive competition and competitive force for these types of assets, even though the basis that you can get is just pretty incredible, historically speaking.
Let's unpack that a little bit because I want to talk about, sort of we've spoke offline about how, if you invested in oil and or gas somewhere in the last decade, you may have gotten smoked. It was not a great time to invest in oil and gas, right? So can you speak a little bit to sort of the historical trends and sort of where we are in the cycle here?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people that like we've been raising, money from people that are mostly real estate investors, right? It's people that are real estate investors. They get really enamored by these really high potential projections, right? Because, the upside is a lot higher a lot of times in oil and gas than maybe in real estate, but there also can come with a little extra risk sometimes because the commodity prices are inherently, more volatile. And so, that has kind of caused these big run-ups and drawdowns. And so you really have to understand where you're at in the cycle to be able to invest intelligently. And, very simply, there's a lot of different metrics you can use, but one of the best metrics that we look at when we're looking at the acquisitions is basically what's your present value return on equity. And basically it's kind of the equivalent of a cap rate, right? So you can lever up these properties a little bit if you want, but if you look at just pure return on assets really is the better metric. And you want to look at the present value. So generally these assets have traded in on current production anywhere from a 10% present value all the way up to a 20% present value. And so it's basically the same as a cap rate, right? So what's your unlevered free cash flow to be generated? And this is usually, it's, you know, from an engineering report. So it builds in all your decline curves, all your depletion, and you can run it against a different, you know, say futures price strip of oil, what the market says the futures price are going to be. And you can get kind of an estimated present value, right? Discounted cash flow. And like right now we're buying assets in the very high end of that range because there's just not that much competition. And we're actually going after, you know, more middle market opportunities where it's a little more capital constrained. You have to be a bigger check writer to go after them. So there's just less competition, and you can get in at the current production at a pretty good basis without having to pay for any upside in oil price or any upside in new drilling, right? Where those two things can add a lot of upside to a project, but also can add more risk as you're, you know, making projections on things that you don't, you know, aren't guaranteed to happen. So, right. All that to say, I think there's been a, you know, kind of a little bit more of a restraint and just discipline. A lot of companies are using less leverage. They're being more disciplined in how they're drilling and the frequency of drilling and not over drilling certain infill locations, to where it's, you know, cannibalizing from other wells and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of kind of just filtering through the whole system here of just more discipline in the market. Mm-hmm. And then meanwhile, you can buy, you know, the existing assets at a pretty good price.
So I just want to kind of restate that. You're saying that, you know, I mean, you can buy existing assets as of right now that cash flow with, if you bought them 100% cash for 15 to 20% cash flow.
Exactly. And, right. And that's on existing production. So, you know, the kind of thing to understand, because you're starting to see a lot more of these deals pop up, right? As right. real estate has a little bit of headwinds just in some of the deals that, you know, were working a year or two ago, aren't working now. So there's less people raising, or harder to find really good deals. A lot of more of these operators have kind of popped up and, you know, raising money. But there's kind of a very wide variety of types and ways to invest in oil and gas. I think this is, you know, where we could kind of tease out a little bit, because I think it's very important to understand what you're investing into,
right?
You know, both from a strategy, the type of asset you're investing in, and the commodities that you're investing in, right? There's multiple layers of risk. But what I'm saying is you can buy existing production. It's called PDP, so proven developed producing wells with proven reserves that are already in production. You can buy that future cash flow at a really, really good present value, and you're not having to pay for the upside of the potential drilling that can happen in those that acreage that you buy, you know, rights to. And so that's what's so attractive about it, where at different points of the market, maybe you have to pay quite a bit of a premium for that upside in the drilling, but now your return is now driven a lot more by having to, you know, have more success in the drilling, which increases the risk.
Interesting. So when you buy something at a 15 or 20% cash flow presently, you know, how many more years does an asset like that have on production?
Yeah, it depends on what the commodity is you're, you know, drilling for, what type of well it is, whether it's horizontal or vertical. But generally, I mean, the types of assets we're going after are generally younger life assets. And, you know, when you're looking at a decline curve or present value calculation, the farther out you go in time, the greater the discount rate. So the less of an impact it has on that present value figure. So generally you look at like a 10-year kind of discounted, you know, annual cash flows, and then you do a terminal valuation at a certain discount rate. And so that kind of drives that present value number. But a lot of times, I mean, these wells can produce for many, 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 many years. Now, obviously, you're going to have a decline in the production as would be expected, because there's a fixed amount in the ground. But, you know, they, like even vertical wells, I mean, some of these wells can produce for 50 plus years, you know.
Wow. That's amazing. Let's switch gears and talk about sort of the, you know, the environmental side of this, because, you know, a lot of people are concerned, you know. We see every day where we blow tens of thousands of pounds of jet exhaust out the back. We are wanting to, you know, I think everybody wants to take care of the planet and everything, right? But the fact is, the cold hard fact is that, you know, that is a little bit farther out than maybe people think. Sustainable aviation fuels aren't quite there yet. Can you talk about how the environmental issues actually might benefit oil and gas investors in the short term? Because essentially, politicians want high oil prices because it will push people, push economies over into sustainable energy and sustainable fuels faster if it's more economically viable.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, you could say I'm a conspiracy theorist or have a big tinfoil hat, but I don't think it's that far fetched to think that, you know, even though the current supply and demand, you know, factors are as they are and where they're kind of projected to go, it's higher probabilities that prices go up from here, right? If you look at any of the investment banks, you know, it's kind of a little bit over the board, and it's sometimes hard to predict exactly where oil prices and natural gas prices go. There's a lot of factors, right, that go into that. But on a long enough time horizon, I think it's pretty clear the directional velocity of prices is going to go up. If you think about it from a political standpoint, that's actually not a bad thing, right? In the short term, it hurts consumers, which, you know, if there's an election year or whatever, maybe that's, you know, they try and time things as much as they can. But in the long run, it actually furthers their agenda, right? Because higher oil prices, the idea behind that is that it creates demand destruction. So basically, right, if oil prices are high enough, consumers will actually change their behaviors, maybe their habits, what they're using, what they're spending, you know, maybe they do less trips, they're less reliant on fossil fuels because it gets more expensive. Right. And the hope would be that, you know, that demand destruction then converts into demand creation for other alternative fuel sources. So yes, I mean, it's something that you could get mad at politicians and say, why aren't we doing more? And I think we should be doing more because I think you can create demand destruction, but it's going to be hard to replace that in alternative fuel sources. And, you know, just at a very simple level, we have not found any other fuel source that is as energy rich, as easily transportable, and that has revolutionized, you know, the industrialization of the entire globe as oil. I mean, there's right, no other fuel source that can, until we crack the code on battery technology to where we can store, you know, energy being created by the sun, by wind, by water, and by nuclear. We're not going to be able to meet the demand for the just pure raw global needs that we have as a country. And so not to get political at all, because that's not any part of our thesis. I think politics right, kind of don't really matter in this because we're playing the pricing game. And I think it's something that benefits those that are on the right side of the pump, is what I've been saying. Get on the right side of the pump and be the one selling oil versus the one having to buy it.
Right. Yeah. And I'm completely on board with that. I think that, you know, there will be some demand destruction in the next few decades, but in the short term, we're just in this really interesting time in history where it's very, very viable. Let's switch gears here and talk about sort of the nuts and bolts of oil and gas investing, because there's a lot of different ways that you can participate in the space as an investor. So can you sort of just lay the groundwork in terms of all the different ways you can be involved, maybe from the least risky to the most risky, because that might be a good way to sort of lay out all the different avenues that you could invest, from wildcat drilling with some small operator that's drilling one well and it's either you hit or you don't, to, you know, buying a stock on the public markets.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways to invest in oil. You know, the simplest way is you go buy public equities and buy share of one of the big, you know, oil companies, right? And, you know, guess who's one of the biggest investors in that right now, one of the greatest value investors of all time? Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett.
You can Google, and he is buying a lot and making some pretty big bets on these oil companies. It's great if you have a lot of capital to deploy in a short amount of time, you know, but there's a lot of direct advantages you can get by investing directly into, you know, the interests of these wells, tax benefits, that is, and just better returns because you're not paying for the liquidity premium of the public markets. So generally, there's kind of two broad types of ways to invest in these types of assets. And one is working interests or royalty interests. And so royalty interests is generally, you've heard mineral rights, mineral leases. This is where you are basically the one that owns the leases, the mineral rights to that to the minerals on that piece of land. And then you lease those rights to the operator and you get a royalty on the production that's generated. So that's more of a cash flow play, more of a passive play in it. There's not a whole lot of tax benefits, but there's no real operational risk to do that, right? You're not taking the risks of all the capital outlays and everything else. But the risk you're taking is, does this operator have a sophistication and ability to produce oil or gas or whatever the commodity is? And for me to actually get a royalty. So there's some pros and cons there. And then the working interest, there's kind of two categories within this space. And this is where you directly participate on the operational side of the well. So you're actually paying the mineral rights owner a royalty to drill. And you can participate either as an operator or a non-operated working interest. If you invest in working interest, you get a lot of tax benefits, which we can get into here in a little bit. You can either participate as an operator or non-operator. If an operator, you're usually going with a smaller mom-and-pop operator that is raising capital and they're kind of doing it well by well. And we've done those types of investments and have talked to a lot of the people that have done those as well. We've evaluated a lot of those types of opportunities. And the challenge with those is really the variance of return and variance of performance, because if you think about it, generally you're going and you're investing into a single well or a few wells or a few potential drilling locations. And when you're doing that in a smaller sample size, you just increase the potential variance of what your returns are going to be. If you hit all the wells, then it's going to be really good. If you miss a couple, then you know, there's going to be some much lower returns or potential loss. And so what we've kind of done and kind of shifted our focus is we've wanted to buy more assets, really play this kind of big macro thesis with the least amount of risk. We're going after more middle market opportunities where you can actually partner alongside of major oil companies. And you can do that as a non-operator, right? And so you think, well, why would a big oil company sell an interest in one of their wells? Well, if you think about it, they have a lot of different wells and assets they're operating, and these are generally very capital-intensive business. And so it can cost anywhere from, it's in the low end, $5 million all the way on the high end to $20 million per well being drilled if it's horizontal wells. And so they want to, just like anybody else, you know, reduce risk on a, you know, idiosyncratic way or an individual well way by spreading out some of their capital. So they'll sell off portions of the drilling and can then spread out their own capital to reduce risk. And so it's actually a great thing because everybody wins in that scenario. And then you're partnering alongside some big operators and are able to get their economies of scale, the experience, the track record. And the kind of final layer and nuance to kind of layer into all different types of ways you can invest in this is, you know, wildcat drilling versus more what we'll call infill drilling. And so probably heard of wildcatting, you know, this is exploratory drilling. These are programs where we evaluate a lot of them, by the way, where you can go and invest in a basin that, hey, there hasn't been a whole lot of wells drilled here yet, but we think there's a really high potential that these could kind of be the next Permian Basin or whatever it is. And you know, with doing that, you're inherently taking a lot more risk because you're one of the first to drill there. And it's not exactly, the geology is less known, right? And so you're taking more risk, but the upside could be a lot higher. On the flip side, there's more infill drilling. So as these basins get drilled out, as the geology gets more well understood, as 3D mapping and, you know, all the data that we kind of can put together gets aggregated, you have a really good sense of what's in the geology, what's in the ground and where the oil is. And so you can start to do infill drilling where, see, there's already been 1,000 wells drilled in this location. We can go drill the 1,000th and first well and have a pretty good likelihood that we're going to hit oil and, you know, do it for a pretty good risk adjusted return. And so that's kind of the whole landscape and where you kind of can tease out, you know, different strategies that you want to kind of participate in this space in.
Yeah, it's interesting how there's such a wide risk spectrum in this space. And there's also a lot of shady operators, right? That was something that, you know, we've, as I mentioned in the intro, we've been, you know, chasing down, you know, an investment opportunity in this space for nearly a year. And something we've learned by talking to our advisors and people who are very experienced in the space is that, you know, they're unlike real estate, which is very public facing and very, very an honest business. There are just some shady operators in the space. You have to be very careful with who you work with, particularly if it's sort of the mom and pop size. And, you know, it's a couple well drilling program where you're just, you know, funding the development of a few wells. So, could you walk us through just a few of these, sort of industry terms like PDP, PUD, NOWI, et cetera, so that people kind of understand what those terms mean, maybe when they look at an oil and gas deal?
Yeah, sure. We've kind of alluded to a lot of them, but mm-hmm. glad you brought it up because there's a lot of vernacular in this space that sometimes is takes a minute to understand. But, you know, PDP and PUD, we'll start there. So you've got PDP is proven developed producing. And so these are actually SEC designations of oil reserves and the types of wells that they are. So it's not something that you can just slap on. Yeah, we got PDP wells here. These are actual proven reserves, which is very difficult to do. It takes a lot of geology, a lot of drilling and testing to get these types of designations with the SEC. And PDP means these are proven, they're developed, and they're producing. And so these are existing wells that have existing production and are expected to produce over a set period of time at a certain decline curve, given the geology they're in, the other wells that are in there in that region, et cetera, et cetera. PUD is also another very difficult designation to get because it's proven undeveloped locations. And so the proven word is the one that's difficult to get because you're basically proving out the reserves in the ground. This is, you know, based on all the testing, based on all the geology, this is what the estimated recoverable oil or gas is in the ground, but we don't have any wells there yet. And so PUDs are very, very valuable in the marketplace because it's you're selling an approved amount of oil in the ground. Now it's just the risk to go and take it out in production. And so those are kind of the kind of two main things that we're looking at. There's other types of, you know, terms and designations, but they get a lot more risky, right? As you kind of go outside of those. And then you have, you know, ORRI and NOWI. So you have overriding royalty interests. Those are basically the mineral interests, mineral leases. And then you have working interests. And then within working interests, you have non-operated working interests and then operated working interests. So the non-operated working interests are generally kind of where we see a lot of opportunity where we're going after participating alongside major oil companies, you know, big companies, and not operating the deal. And the cool thing as a non-operated working interest owner, one, you get all the tax benefits of a working interest owner. Two, you get to benefit on the scale and the economies of scale, the track record experience of these big oil companies. And then thirdly, you actually get the right to participate in any of the new drilling programs that is on the acreage that you have rights to, but you don't have the requirement to. Right. So you can ascertain whether a drilling program that an oil company presents to you saying, hey, we think there's a really good high likelihood of striking oil in this drilling program. It's going to cost X. Here's the timeline it's going to be. Here's what we think the estimated IRR is going to be. Do you want to participate? Well, we have that optionality to decide yes or no based on what we think the risk return profile is going to be on that. And so you kind of get the best of both worlds where you get that exposure to the upside through the new drilling because the return profile are, you know, as expected, going to be a lot higher, taking more risk, right? But sometimes, you know, 50% plus IRRs on a gross basis for some of these new drilling programs. But you can always say no if you don't like the deal. So that's what we like about that kind of niche within a niche, if you want to call it that.
All right. Well, that's super interesting. Thanks for clearing up all that. Let's talk a little bit about the tax benefits, because that's one of the most exciting things, I think, about investing in this space. To give the listeners some background, you know, when you invest in real estate, there are some incredible tax benefits that you can get from real estate. But usually, unless you're a real estate professional or you're operating your own property as a short-term rental, it's very difficult to write any of that depreciation off against your active income, which is the biggest issue that we have as airline pilots is making too much money and paying too much tax, right? So any way that we can get active tax losses, we're looking for them. So can you kind of run us through what the tax benefits look like in the oil and gas space and maybe how they relate to different types of participation?
Absolutely. Well, first off, it's always a good problem to have if you're making so much money, you have to pay a lot of taxes. So we'll just start there. Way to go, very pilots. True. You're rocking it. But it's still a problem. And so we got to figure out how to reduce it, right? I think it's very comparable to real estate in a lot of ways, but it has even some extra advantages depending on how it's structured. So you kind of have three primary types of tax advantages in oil and gas. You have intangible drilling costs, you have tangible drilling costs, you have depletion expense, which is very similar to depreciation. It's kind of, you know, what's the estimated, you know, depletion of the resources that have been pulled out of the ground and what's that, you know, relate to economically, and the tax code allows you to write that off. You also have depreciation on some of the equipment that you use to produce the oil. And so you have these kind of three things. And one of the cool things about it is you can structure these investments as partnerships. And when you structure as a partnership, you can invest a lot of times as a general partner into the partnership or as a limited partner. So a general partner doesn't mean you're actually operating the investment, but you're investing alongside, say, the managing partner as a general partner. And by doing that, you're maybe taking a little bit more risk as a general partner, which we could dive into if you want. But the kind of trade-off for that is you can actually take those losses and use them against active or earned income, which is not something you can do in real estate unless, to your point, you're a real estate professional. And so there's some pretty big advantages to doing that. But even if you don't want to take the extra risk of being a general partner, tax losses actually get pushed through against the income being generated off the asset or other, you know, passive income. And so it's still as good as real estate, if not slightly better, depending on how you invest into a deal.
What are the tax benefits? What's kind of the range if you're buying existing assets versus just doing a pure drill play?
Yeah, so I think you make a good point there, because I think it is an important thing to understand going back to the question of what am I investing in and what's the strategy here. I think it's first really important to understand what that is, because I will say I've seen a lot of deals come across my desk and we've underwritten deals. I think a lot of people get allured by the tax benefits without really thinking through what's the actual strategy of the deal, right? Because sure, I can get a big write-off year one, but is it even worth investing in it outside of that, right? And so I always say, don't let the tax tail wag the dog, right? It should be an important part of the consideration of investment, but it should never be the primary driver of an investment, because, okay, maybe you make an investment because of the tax benefits, but if that value of the asset or whatever the strategy is creates a big fat zero on a loss of principal, well,
doesn't really matter.
That's not a situation anyone wants to be in. So I make that point only to say, again, understand what you're investing in, because there are deals, and this is not exactly what we're doing, so I want to be clear on that, where it's just a pure drilling program. So it's, hey, we have three wells, we're going to go drill. You can pre-fund a lot of those expenses in a calendar year, and we can write off, say, 50, upwards of 100% of the investment you can get in kind of year one tax losses. So that's possible. Those are out there. But again, you're taking a lot more risk on those, you know, three wells actually working out. And so on those types of deals, I've seen a very big variance of return and talking with people that have invested in those. And then what we're doing is buying existing production and then leveraging that cash flow to invest in more drilling and then layer on, you know, other drilling on top of that. So you get kind of the best of both worlds. You get cash flow, you get upside, and you get some tax benefits. Generally, the tax benefits aren't going to be as substantial because, one, you have existing cash flow that you're generating, which, again,
offsets
it. Pilots make a lot of money. If you're making money, it's never a bad thing. But it's possible that, you know, maybe your drilling expenses don't exceed the income being generated. But in that scenario, then it's worst case scenario is the returns that you're earning are mostly tax deferred, you know, kind of like real estate would be. So, you know, regardless of how you invest in it, make sure you understand what you're investing in and what's the strategy And what are the tax implications related to that strategy?
Excellent. Well, on that note, we actually have a deal open as of right now with Aspen Funds. I mentioned this in the intro, but at Turbine Capital, we've been bringing on some energy advisors, and we've been working on direct to sponsor relationships, and we've been working to find an oil and gas deal for our investors because we think it's a very creative asset class at this moment in history. But as we mentioned, you know, there's a lot of interesting players in the space, and it takes time to build relationships. We saw the deal that Aspen Funds was bringing to market. We have looked it over with all of our advisors, and we're really excited about it. So Aspen Funds has put this deal together with funds like ours, and that's the way to get involved. So Ben, we have a few minutes here if we want to just touch briefly on the Aspen Energy Fund that we currently have open on our portal.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, we're working with you and Turbine Capital to kind of help get this fund launched. We've had a great response so far. We're shooting to raise as a whole about $50 million. We're already at $40 million there. So we're well on our way to fully fund this thing. You know, having you along for the ride is going to be really fun as a partner. So excited to have you in there. But, you know, our strategy on this is kind of what I mentioned before, you know, going and buying existing producing assets that have potential for new drilling. So you can get some of the upside, but you're mitigating that by having existing production, existing cash flow, which is always a good thing. Mm-hmm. And then we're participating usually as a non-operated working interest owner. So you get the tax benefits, but then you get the benefit of the size and scale of these operators. And so we actually have our first asset under contract right now. And as an example, you know, of the 8 operators, we have 140 wells in this first asset. You're getting diversification across, you know, a large number of wells. It produces 3 different commodities: oil, natural gas, and natural gas liquids. You get commodity diversification. And then you have operator diversification. So we have 8 different operators, and 5 of the 8 are publicly traded companies that are multi-billion dollar market cap companies. And so you're getting a nice diversification, you know, geographically, operationally, and some of the commodities prices as well. So we think it's a great strategy to kind of go after in this particular market. We think it's a great time to be buying. We're buying this at a really good basis. And we think now is the time to scoop up as much of these assets as we can, maximize the value by doing more drilling. And then, you know, as the market comes back over time, looking for opportunistic time to sell.
Excellent. Well, we'll link to the deal room in the show notes. This will only be open for a couple of weeks. We got a very small equity allocation in that fund. We're very fortunate to get that. If you're listening to this sometime in the future, if you're on our list, we're always going to be looking for opportunistic stuff like this. But Ben, thank you so much for coming on. And if you go to that deal room, there's not only a masterclass on oil and gas investing that's about an hour and a half long with you, Bob Frazier, and also Jeff Mohajer from Mohajer Energy Advisors, but also our deal-specific webinar. So if you'd like to check that out, link is in the show notes. Ben, thank you so much for joining. And before we jump off, do you want to tell the listeners a little bit more how they could get in touch with you if they wanted to?
Yeah, and just as one little aside as well, in this particular fund, the principals of the fund, including the Aspen principals, are investing in excess of $7 million of personal cash as LPs in this deal. And so there's a big alignment of interest, a big belief in this structure and strategy. And yeah, you know, best way, if you like podcasts, you can check out our podcast, Invest Like a Billionaire. But definitely, if you're interested, reach out to Tate. And we're only really taking funds at this point through capital raisers like Tate and Turbine. So be sure to check out the deal room and check out all the information we got there for you.
Excellent. Ben, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate you.
All right. Thanks, Tate.
Take care.